Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. What's the point of all that you do up there in space, of course? Don't we have enough problems down here? Even our dear friend Moriba Jha over on Vox Populi gets tight-lipped about this question, especially when it comes from his own family, as he himself says. There is something to the question with all the housework we still have imposed on ourselves down here, right? At first glance, I would say. On the second, though, things look a little different. Different when you turn the tables and ask what space can do for the problems on Earth. Ask not what you can do for space, but ask what space can do for you, or so to paraphrase good old JFK. And that is exactly why we invited a very special guest today. I'm starting to get repetitive, I guess. Of course, every guest is special here on Space Cafe Podcast. Perhaps I should say a guest you may not have heard of too often, especially from within the new space world.
We are calling to the space community at Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. We're in desperation for your expertise, the drive and innovation of our space colleagues, because this is how we see the whole world.
Joelle Russell is an oceanographer, climate scientist, and distinguished university professor at the University of Arizona. In her fight against climate change, she uses robot floats, satellites, and supercomputers. Curious? You should be, I promise. And just by the way,
we will have to make hard choices and changes.
Make yourselves comfortable and listen for yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. Join me in welcoming Professor Joelle Russell to the Space Cafe Podcast.
I'm a professor at the University of Arizona, and I use robot floats, supercomputers, and satellites to try and get ahead of the tremendous change in our climate that is going on our planet right now.
The general of a friendly army.
Oh, it's just friends reaching friends across. We hook arms to try and make change as fast as we can. I have two small children, and there is nothing I wouldn't do to be able to see the prosperity of my grandchildren, which I don't have yet, but I would like to have. So We do everything we can individually, and then we reach out and call to arms our friends and colleagues around the world and across our country to try and move faster.
How pressing is that call?
The thing that's worrying me right now is that we saw during pandemic, even with the global lockdown and the drop in emissions from all of our cars and homes and power plants, that in fact, the carbon dioxide rose by almost over 3 parts per million during that year because of feedbacks kicking in our global ocean and the wildfires that are burning because of drought in California, in Siberia, in Australia. And these are all feedbacks on climate change, and they are global. They aren't just one tiny little spot. Also, of course, these were La Nina years where the winds blew a little more strongly in the tropical Pacific, which normally works like an air conditioner for everybody. We almost never have our hottest years when the colder waters being upwelled in the tropical Pacific due to increased winds. And you know how we see that. We have some buoys there, but normally we see that from satellite, right? We see that by looking in at our, because the vast Pacific, it's so enormous. Hot years during La Nina has not been seen. This is new. I'm worried that we've reached a tipping point where we're upwelling warmer water that's been pre-warmed by our anthropogenic human-derived atmosphere. So yeah, when everyone says, why are you worried about this? I'm like, in the 90s, we were increasing by 1 part per million. In the 2000s, we were adding 2 ppm to the atmosphere. And now we're at 3.4. 1 year it was 3.8 parts per million. We are not slowing. And it's partly us, but even during pandemic, that means that now the planet itself is responding.
I'm sure you've heard of the Cassandra myth from ancient times.
Yes, of course.
I feel like that today's scientists are today's Cassandras. Because so to our audience, the Cassandra myth is all about the ancient princess who was supposed to be or who was said to be cursed to always tell the truth and no one would believe her. So is that an analogy we should draw?
I have so much more hope than that. I do. You are right. And we think of that. But there's two parts. One, I have these amazing colleagues like Marie Bajah and others who are, look, we're all moving in the same direction. How does it go? We work alone, together, in the same direction. It's a no-look pass, right, across the world and ongoing. So I feel my people with me every day.
Sure.
But also, the United States has not really organized. The Supreme Court ruled in 2007 that carbon dioxide is in fact covered under our Clean Air Act from the 70s as a pollutant. Yes, they ruled this. It's the law of the land that carbon dioxide must be regulated. Not a coincidence that our peak emissions were 4 months later. And ever since then, we've been decreasing. We are now 20% off our peak emissions. However, we don't have a carbon tax. We don't have trading markets the same way they have in Europe. We don't even have a fully integrated emissions carbon accounting system. We aren't organized yet that way. However, 20% off peak emissions. That means a whole lot of companies and people basically were making wise decisions for our future and to save a buck. Let's just be honest. Yeah. Better efficiency just saves you money. There's no downside here. So I have hope that, in fact, while we are not as organized as we could be, and we have certainly not picked up a leadership role, which we absolutely should as such a rich country, and having such a legacy of emissions and Standard Oil and all the rest of it, we in fact are moving. And you just can't hear it from our politicians yet, but we're moving. We are. And we see how hard Europe has been working to already try and rein that in. So in fact, I have enormous hope that in fact that our human tipping point has already been reached, but that we will now accelerate. Hope.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Seriously. So space and the oceans have a few things in common, I should say, because of course this is primarily a space podcast. Now we need to draw that connection to the oceans. So the things space and oceans have in common is, to our feeble human minds, that is, they are vast and unfathomable. And
yes,
they are polluted, both of them.
Yes.
Because we have space debris and we have pollution in the ocean. So how bad is it for our oceans?
The decay rates, I think, in the ocean are quicker. We have a lot of UV reaching the surface. So a lot of the plastic debris in particular it breaks down over time. Even the tiny particles eventually break down. It takes a long time, decades in some cases, maybe even 100 years for certain other kinds of materials, but it does decay. It is a rough environment in the ocean. I would say that in many cases that the debris in our close orbit is much more dangerous because it doesn't decay unless it bumps into something else. And then eventually it really can just, I think we're creating soup up there, maybe even stew, which is terrible, which unlike in the ocean where we do actually have a straight up destruction created by waves and turbulence and UV and the corrosion, it is salt water. It is tough for ships and other, that's why it's so hard to work there. It's also very dangerous. It is like space, where at one point I was 14 days transit from land and the ship was taking on water because it's a major research vessel, but it was the side scan sonar set into the hull had peeled away because of bashing from waves and was starting to leak. So they docked the hatches on one compartment, put in sump pumps, put in some more. But you realize at 14 days transit, the middle of the South Pacific off Antarctica, that there's no one coming. If there's a problem, you have to fix it. And no one notices when it's a ship that's having trouble the way that they notice if one of our spacecraft have difficulty. It's a worldwide media phenomenon. And that's right. Wonderful because right. We all gasped to see that. We're like, oh, what can we do to get them home? Can they fix it? Ah! Right. Whereas at sea, we work alone and no one notices. You may not even be able to really communicate except by a military satellite if you're far enough away. It is a challenge. And so I deeply appreciate those parallels between our space exploration and our ocean exploration. It's difficult. It's far away. It's hard. And accidents happen. If you didn't bring it with you, it's not there.
So what happened to that leaking boat?
Oh, we had a wise captain who reined in our chief scientist and said, no, we're not staying even another day out here. The waves were 100 feet high. I know that sounds like nothing, but they were mountains of water that on the bridge, which is on the up two decks from the deck of the ship, the water on a good day was like this little spritz on the bridge. And that's pretty high to get water up there in a calm sea. But in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica, it is completely wild. So these mountains of water would be so big that the albatross and the petrels would swoop around them like fighter pilots. You couldn't see them. They disappear behind the mountain and then come whooshing back around minutes and minutes later. And the ship itself would chub up the side of a wave and then swoosh down, almost zero G as you come down. But the problem is there's a bottom in the trough and your prow would dig into the next wave and the mountain would proceed to fall on you. And the water on the bridge would be black. I still have nightmares. I do. I wake up, I can't breathe. Like there's black water over your head and you can't figure out where the surface is. But the ship knows. And she jerks and she heaves trying to get back up. And the way the winds and the waves we now observe from space, from our satellites, as well as our in-situ robot floats that we've been deploying through my group and my efforts, we now know that the current has accelerated, that the waves are higher, that the wind speeds have increased due to climate change, and that is driving an even wilder ocean. And
because there's more energy coming into the ocean.
It is. We have an activated atmosphere that's now driving the ocean. And we see this. If we were just doing one little research vessel sitting out in the ocean, I realized this decades ago, sitting in the I'm trying to do these measurements. And then what happens in the next season? What happens if I miss the storm because I had to go back to shore? Right? If I miss one of the storms, then I don't know how much gas exchange there was, how much heat uptake. I don't know. And I need all the storms in order to get a budget. So we see this basically a combination of in-situ robot floats that could be out in the ice and not be endangering anyone. And we worry about our debris. Are we leaving things on the bottom? So unlike you with the space debris, we can make ours edible. We have bacteria that will eat it for us. If you make a housing that is made out of an edible plastic, you can actually get the bacteria to eat it for you. I know. It's good. We do have some advantages here at Ocean World.
Fascinating. But where's that bacteria? Like that could be quite a business model for someone to do it because there's a bunch of oceans to be cleaned.
Yes, there are. Now, we don't generally want to introduce more we don't want to feed the bacteria strange human products. But if we need these sensors to be out in the world in order to tell us, be able to do better weather and climate prediction, we have to have the information in near real time.
Sure.
So we need these. But we don't want to junk up our oceans. So we're trying to increase that decay. The natural decay takes decades. Can we accelerate that by making more of the housings and other components out of materials that the bacteria eventually, especially in the sediments when they sink to the bottom, will eat and therefore reduce the amount of impact we're having?
Wow. Fascinating. But
I know you can't ask. I don't think that would work in space.
not yet. Maybe we can like put that those bacteria, make them space safe and put them into tiny glass bubbles or something like that. Well, then they wouldn't be able to eat the outside stuff. But let me get back to your little voyage amongst the raging seas. So would next year's voyage or the years after next year's voyage be even more fierce because the climate is picking up speed and change, that is?
Yes. Yes. And the reason here is actually that our troposphere, our lower atmosphere, it's warming. Our upper atmosphere, not all the way out where our satellites are, but in our stratosphere, because of ozone destruction. Did you know we had an Arctic ozone hole last summer? We did. We had an Arctic ozone hole. We normally only have Antarctic ozone holes, but we had an Arctic one. And the reason is that the stratosphere is cooling. This is the signature of human-derived climate change. If it were the sun, you would see the upper atmosphere and the lower atmosphere varying together. But because it's this increase in carbon dioxide from our burning of fossil fuels, the lower atmosphere warms and the upper atmosphere cools. And even if the ozone recovers because we emit fewer of the chlorofluorocarbons that are ozone-destroying chemicals that we use as refrigerants, or we used to, they've now been banned by the Montreal Protocol. Look at how awesome cooperation internationally works when we all work together. Yes, we do. But we need to get our politicians to move like our scientists have already moved. We can, humans do this. Humans can. We do. Across disciplines, across distance, across incapacity building, and in every other way, all of us together. So I know that this can work. It's just, gosh, they're stubborn. But yes, so the stratosphere is cooling. We've got almost 7 degrees colder over the South Pole. And the troposphere, of course, is between 1 and 2 degrees warmer. So that temperature difference, the temperature gradient between our upper and lower atmosphere is almost 10 degrees Celsius. That, according to any thermal wind, which I might give my students on their grad student oral comp on their comps, what does thermal wind do when you increase the gradient? It roars. So our jet streams in the northern and southern hemisphere are being goosed by the increased temperature gradient. In the past, in previous IPCCs back in 2001 or whatever, they said if the polar amplification of warming, you know, if it warms quicker near the poles, then with the albedo change from the sea ice and all the rest of it, then what will happen is we'll warm the poles and the tropics will warm as quick. So we'll basically flatten the temperature gradient between the equator and the pole, which will weaken the winds. But this was back when all the climate models and weather models were run without a stratosphere. We're now running whole atmosphere models, ones that go all the way up to where our satellites are orbiting, because we want to do space weather, in addition to because solar winds, et cetera, affect our satellites as well as our communications. So we understand now that we were neglecting parts of our of what is Earth and her influence. And so I can't wait to be able to use these to start thinking about, are there patterns in the lower part of our atmosphere, drivers that are now continuing, that both internal and external, affecting the patterns of our space waste? And can we use those as little drifter particles to try and look at some of this? Sorry, it is very cool science. It's not maybe directly relevant to climate, but it's so intensely interesting to see how connected our whole environment is, from the space to the bottom of the ocean. We are all moving together in the same direction.
That's so fascinating. And that reminds me a little of that. You mentioned Moriba Jha. He does a beautiful series called Moriba's Vox Populi. And you are featured on the current episode. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Moriba refers to a sort of renaissance of a Gaia hypothesis, where the Earth is, and everything on it is interconnected and is a closed loop system. And I think this is something that we're forgetting in our little bubble that we're in, that everything we do is playing back upon us in whatever form. Is that the way that science is seeing the world at the moment, and climate change and whatever?
It is the mass of energy, right? We are digging up the ancient harvested sunlight of millions and millions of years, and we're burning it that energy is now released and is now chemical energy working in our atmosphere and then creates all these changes in the circulation. This is a molecule of carbon dioxide out of anybody's tailpipe. One out of four goes into the ocean. One out of four goes into the terrestrial biosphere through greening. And two stays hanging in the atmosphere. And the removal rates, given our enormous emissions, it can hang for as long as 1,000 years, warming us for all of that time, each molecule. So whenever anybody says, maybe we can still burn fossil fuels. We'll just work on geoengineering. We'll just work on carbon capture. We'll just work on carbon dioxide removal. And I keep thinking, or we could just leave it where it is. We could just leave it where it is. Let's not activate it and bring it into our atmosphere to accelerate all this change. This is the ancient stored sunlight. Let's let it lie. Let's not have to try to capture it later. Let's not try to have to remove it. Let's not try to live with the consequences. Let's, in fact, find better ways to electrify our lives that that have zero carbon net impact. There are many, whether it's solar or wind or nuclear, there are many that can be used that are net zero, hydrothermal. There are many, and we have not put all of our efforts into transitioning yet. And I wonder if they understand what they are doing with the basic function of our planet and the energy budget within it. Once you release, once the genie is out of the bottle, putting it back in, which took millions of years when the Tethys Ocean was open. That is an unbelievable task. Not the one that we couldn't find is, it's not impossible for us, but it would be extraordinarily expensive. And so I would prefer to put all of that money and energy into art and music and our children and living better, cleaner, happier lives. Why would we want to spend that on energy systems when we could spend it on on beauty and livability and fun?
Joellen, thank you so much for that segue, because I would like to propose a hard cut now. And that hard cut would be, if you agree, to not talk about climate change and if it is happening or if it's not happening, if it's human-made or not human-made. Let's stop talking about it, because I believe that science has given us enough evidence that things are changing. And it doesn't matter if that is human-made, it doesn't matter whatever the reason is, things are changing. So whoever does not want to believe this, I think we're not going to be changing that situation. We've been debating that for decades now.
There's no debate. You could come look at. So most of the energy imbalance for our planet is in the ocean. Every year, 93% of the excess energy that's created by all of this greenhouse gas. And we know how much there is because, of course, ERBE, Earth's Radiation Budget Experiment, is a series of satellites that sits out at the edge of our atmosphere, basically looks out at the sun and in at the Earth. And ERBE tells us that net energy imbalance grows every year. The same comes in, but less gets out. And some wise guy will say, but how come one year it warms a lot and one year it doesn't? Well, because the accumulation of that energy in the atmosphere is only 3% of the energy imbalance. 93% is being absorbed by our oceans. Oceans are the heat capacitor of the planet, and they are absorbing and absorbing. Now, during an El Nino, we generally get a fraction of that heat back, which is why we almost always have record hot years during El Nino years. This is the functioning of our planet. We observe this from satellite, from robot float, from buoys, from ships. We have a tremendous observation system, both the United States and internationally. And these have been coordinated for decades and decades across nations and around the world to look at these problems. So no, there is no debate about whether or not it's warming. And really, some reason I didn't see it in the atmosphere. I'm like, I saw it in the ocean. That's where it went. We know where it went. Yeah. And it contributed to sea level rise. And it contributed to the death of half of the Great Barrier Reef through bleaching. It contributed to the death of our Caribbean reefs. It contributed to the death of our Indian Ocean reefs. everyone who imagines that there is some alternative to all of this excess ancient sunlight that we have now added to the chemistry of atmosphere, I understand we would like it if our problems would just go away, but we created them. We know what we did. We know how much we did. And we even know exactly where the carbon's going and who did it.
And I heard that climate change is even affecting the satellites out there.
Yes.
So what up with that?
So the problem is that as the troposphere is warming and the ocean-driven hot convection is getting, it's raising the top of the tropopause, that transition from the lower atmosphere to the stratosphere. It's actually going up like 100 meters every few years. So as the atmosphere literally expands around the Earth to accommodate this more active convection, we are actually increasing the drag on our low Earth orbiting satellites, because the number of molecules of atmosphere that they're interacting with is increasing as we expand our atmosphere. I know, isn't that wild? Here it comes.
It's absolutely.
So a prediction was made about how that should be happening, and then they compared it to the actual trajectories on the satellites, and in fact, it was true. Similar things were done with science works. So similar things were done with our radiosondes, or the balloons with the weather measurements that go from the surface, and we release them. They go all the way up through the stratosphere. It's very important data. So a very clever man called Steve Sherwood, who works at the University of New South Wales, he is brilliant. I really enjoy his work. He said, okay, so if we have this increased gradient in the atmosphere between our lower and upper atmosphere, we have this increased gradient, there should be increased wind. So I could do a calculation based on the change in the temperature gradient, and that should be how much faster the winds go. And I'm going to verify that by looking at how far we have to correct our radiosonde data to get to vertical, because you want a profile of the atmosphere, but they're blown by the winds. So we always do this sort of correction to get them back up to straight so we could give you a straight profile, even though the measurements they were making come basically bend with the wind as it goes up. And so he did the calculation, and then he looked at the correction factors. And sure enough, bang, thermal wind works. The physics are correct. Ta-da. It's amazing.
Do you then, I don't know, dance around a table?
Oh, no, I did. We tweet on Twitter. Everybody's like, oh, Twitter's such a cesspit. I'm like, oh, my God, just follow the scientists and the poets. Honestly, you'll find nothing but joy. It really is just extraordinary to watch all these people trying.
How do scientists celebrate?
Oh, there's a lot of alcohol involved. During pandemic, it has had to be by Zoom, but I cannot tell you how many Zoom happy hours I've been to. We do celebrate because there's just extraordinary advances being made. So much more we can see. And part of that is that space has become more accessible. The number of launch options. I have proposed this new satellite. I need more wind information over the ocean, exactly for all the reasons we've been talking about, and these big storms and what they're doing to the carbon budget of the planet and blah, blah, blah. I proposed to Earth Venture Mission, which is a NASA call, a $200 million small sat that would allow us to get more information about the winds over the ocean using a very new kind of awesome scatterometer, and that would place in an orbit that would then complement the current scatterometers up there to get us go from two measurements per day to four, basically creating a constellation based on observing system design experiments, et cetera. So we proposed this, but I actually was able to go out and get bids for our launch to estimate, and there were options, right? Now, this has never really been the way this goes. You basically go to NASA and say, please, sir, can you put this into orbit for me? And so it's just extraordinary, the space ecosystem that has evolved, both commercial and our industrial partners and the federal agencies around the world and in the U.S. that have all, Europe, China, India, et cetera, that are now making space applications. Now, there are the downside of the debris, et cetera, the sort of Wild West aspect of dumping. However, there's also for these extraordinary Earth science space applications, we would never be able to do that. That's not our gig. But being mm-hmm. able to move more quickly to get in front of our science problems and solve them so that every person on planet Earth can benefit from the improved predictions and better information for adaptation. I had to get my kids up at 5 a.m. this summer because it was so hot that they wouldn't have any time outdoors to play. They need to ride their bikes. They need to see the sky. Mm. I live in Arizona in the desert. Mm. And we are at elevation, so normally it's not this hot, but things are changing. Our normal is 6,200 degree Fahrenheit days, which is quite, you have to keep the kids, monitor my mm-hmm. little one pretty carefully to make sure she doesn't, she came mm-hmm. home after a bike ride and said, Mama, I feel sick. I have a headache mm-hmm. and I want to barf. And I'm like, oh no, she mm-hmm. had a little bit of heat stroke and she was only out for a short while and it wasn't that hot. She wore her helmet. Mm-hmm. We worry. Our kids, we need these predictions. We need to adapt and adapt quickly and wisely and with as little greenwashing and overbuilding as possible, especially so that we can transfer more of that capacity to folks who have fewer resources to do that adaptation. And so I just find the fact that the space industry has moved so quickly and is so nimble is really extraordinary. And if we could couple that to the same kind of sustainability efforts that we have mm-hmm. for our Earth applications, wouldn't it be extraordinary to make these gains but not pay the maximum reckless cost of them? Would be wonderful with just a little foresight and planning.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Joelle, I'm super serious. Let's take that opportunity we have here with our little show to look into the future and try to come up with inspiration, with ideas for a sustainable future, that is. So the question would be, this predicament we're in at the moment was caused by a system that we like to live in. And we call that a growth-driven and fossil fuel-devouring system that believes in the non-finite resources and whatnot on Earth. So the question is, can we fix this system to make our future livable, or do we need another system?
Oh, I worry. I'll say, as a woman, as a person who's given birth to 2 children, I'm worried that if we don't, I will have no grandchildren. And the reason will be that our children will choose not to have children. Birth rates are dropping all over the world. In almost all but like 3 countries in Africa, birth rates are dropping catastrophically. And 80% of this, according to the Lancet's cool new article, says that 80% of this is due to a combination of women's education, years of education that we've been denied for most of human history, and access to birth control, family planning. And a lot of that is to do with, and I'm sorry to be on a space podcast talking about this, but the fact is these 2 things, because I'm a distinguished professor at the University of Arizona, and for most of human history, I would not be allowed. We see those things in Afghanistan where those female professors will not be allowed and those girls will not be educated. And what I worry is that hope, that thing we've been talking about, if hope dies, if we don't believe that we can provide a better future for our children, we won't have any. We are already looking at tremendous population decline. And so that growth mentality of bigger, it won't exist because, you know, the one-child policy in China has now been reversed to 2 or, hey, even maybe 3. And there's a new child tax credit delivered straight to your bank account here in the United States. And so these are slow and small acknowledgments that if things don't get better for mothers and children, if the hope doesn't exist that they will live better lives than we did, if it feels like their children are more of a burden than a joy. And I have a hard time imagining that because I love the 2 miracle babies mm-hmm. I have in my house so much. And I want grandchildren. I think a lot of people would like to have them. But if we don't get in front of this, if our generation, you and me, Mariba Torsten, if we don't lock arms and press for better, press for sustainable, press for hope. This, we will, there's the Gaia hypothesis is really actually was never my favorite because it implied that the planet would save itself. And I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's up to us who made the mess to clean it. And so I, here in Arizona, we have Palo Verde. It's the most productive nuclear power plant in the United States. It provides 42% of our electricity here in the state. We even sell some of it. And it actually it's paid for by our grandparents, basically. It's paid for. It drinks toilet water from Phoenix, the fifth largest city in our country. And somebody asked me, so what happens if the water goes away? And I'm like, that would mean that Phoenix had a zombie apocalypse and there were no more people flushing toilets. That's never going to happen, that there are no people flushing toilets. So it's a completely well-contained, sustainable system. And all of the waste is in the backyard in an Olympic-sized swimming pool that has ever been created within the security of the plant. That's it. We've just decided that tiny Walmart parking lot kind of size of facility provides all this energy and is in a place that is the lowest hazard area in the nation here in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's our lowest hazard state. And that's it. So I keep looking at it going, I know how we could do this. There are mm-hmm. ways, and our grandparents were thinking about it. So now where the bills come due and we owe, and we're going to have to work hard together to pay it and be clever and smart and far thinking and build more carefully for our great grandbabies that even exist yet. And if we don't, that the despair that is that opposite of hope will mean that more and more of us will not have grandchildren, right? Because more and more people will just choose not to. I don't know if you saw in Nature, they have an article out just this week on the fight between the UN demographers, the United Nations demographers, and other groups who are saying, hey, we don't think we're even going to talk all of these rosy projections about how much population growth. I don't think it's going to be that high. So now mm-hmm. the new estimates are we won't hit 10 billion. And there's a downside possibility that we won't even come close. And that's fine. I agree with you that the population bomb has been defused. There is no more population bomb. That we are already within a billion and a half people of top carrying for all of the planet ever. We're already there. So rebuilding our systems now to be more sustainable, we have the ability to feed everyone, to house everyone, to clothe everyone. We do. We make enough stuff. So it's not going to be about stuff. It's going to be about values. It's going to, hopefully, if we were smart, it would be about joy and art and education and fun, and not about polluting fossil fuel industry that drives us into having to adapt wildly because we couldn't get in front of our carbon emissions. Just hoping.
So I think, thank you for that beautiful speech, seriously. I think many things boil down to education, and you just mentioned that word, education, because by the time you understand how things are connected, you just won't do some things anymore because you understand the consequences. So I believe, especially just around the corner here, so in Austria is a pretty tidy place, I would say.
It's lovely. Still, I've been to visit. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's a lovely place, and I live in a very lovely place right next to Vienna. I live amidst a forest in a little valley, very beautiful, very green. And whenever I go running next to a little creek right across the street, I would find lots and lots of pieces of trash right next to the road. So the question is, why would people do something like this? Why would you open your window and throw out your whatever you want to throw out? I believe, and this is my thesis, that this boils down to a lack of education. And I'm not talking about ideologized education or whatever, but basic education, what it is to be a human being.
Yes, it's kindergarten education. Don't take other people's things. Share. Yes. These are what we teach our children when they are small. Don't hit. Share these things. Don't take other kids' toys. We teach them these things as children. Our sustainability. Don't litter. Don't waste. Don't use what you don't need. These things need to be part of our basic childhood, how we bring them up. You watch mama. You watch daddy. You watch them. You watch them lead this better, more sustainable life. That doesn't mean you can't drive the whole family to church. It just means that hopefully you're driving an electric vehicle.
Exactly.
It means that we make choices to have a smaller, as they say in our national parks, they say, take only pictures, leave only footprints. This needs to be part of our bedrock education, the same way you'd say, don't hit. We don't hit each other. We talk. These are basic things. And all humans teach their children these things. But sustainability, the leave nothing but footprints, take only photos, is a little bit new. It's a little bit, my grandfather, who's gone now, he used to talk about taking this trip with my grandmother to visit the in-laws, going from Seattle to Spokane, which is across the Cascade Mountains. And he would put a six-pack of beer in his lap, all of his children without wearing seatbelts. He had five kids, and they would all load up the family station wagon, just throw the kids inside with a baby sitting on grandma's lap. And he would put the six-pack of beer on his lap, and he would throw the cans out the window as he drove. And he said about a six-pack got him to Spokane. I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's so many things wrong with that pop. One, you're drinking and driving. Two, you've got all the kids under a string. Three, you're throwing the cans out the window. So we do change. We are not who our grandparents were.
Yes, yes. But they back in the day, to them, that was perfectly fine to do. And no one would say something against it. Because that was a certain state of mind in a certain state of, I don't know, period of time, that is.
I think there was this idea about wilderness and frontiers and settling and colonialism that we've now come to understand is inappropriate and doesn't work very well, does not describe the real world, that Indigenous peoples had already walked all over those lands. Many of them were already managed by them, both the fire, the landscape, the organisms that live there. And that European and American intrusion has made major changes in all of that. But we'd like to think that it was tabula rasa, that there was nothing there before, which is total bunk. It's an extraordinary thing to be in the process of building our history, building our brains, building our sustainability, all in aid of this collaboration of humans that now realize that we don't own this one little spot in the world that isn't affected by anything else, although that was never true. But that all of what we do, it connects to what all of you do, what we are, we co-develop this atmosphere, this ocean. And when you see the drop in human fertility, which is going country by country, all of a sudden you start to look at it and go, that's irrespective of government system, irrespective of this planetary potential despair, right, over so worried about what's next or whether you can afford your children that you don't have them. That to me says that we share more, so much more in this little tiny spaceship Earth than are different. So much more. We are not other or they, we are we. And we are going to have to move together. I'm part of a group called Science Moms, and we're just trying, climate scientists who happen to be mothers, who are trying to get the word out on climate and get people writing their congresspeople and speaking across the back fence to their friends. Because we, like you were saying earlier, we have a problem that not everyone is on board. This hasn't become sustainability and this teaching our children, basically, don't hit. Share, leave nothing but footprints. We haven't quite managed that education step, even though we all are sharing the consequences on this tiny spaceship Earth. So I have such hope, and I worry.
You know what? There's one thing I would say I would differ with you, and that is when you mentioned that you didn't really like the Gaia hypothesis when it comes to its ultimate consequence, that the Earth heals itself. I believe the Earth heals itself by getting rid of the polluters as the ultimate consequence. Of course, we wouldn't want that. But now let's keep up the ball high in the air, because this is so inspiring what we're doing here. A brief spoiler alert: our next episode of the Space Cafe podcast will focus on some radical new ways of imagining social coexistence. Ooh. As they are tested for our upcoming lunar visits. And what I'm saying is that the moon offers these days a fascinating sandbox for some crazy ideas, because the moon is a tabula rasa, a new place, because we have the Outer Space Treaty and blah, blah, blah. And so the moon is a new place, to a new test bed for maybe a future society. You already mentioned that you think that the space industry has a lot to inspire, or is quite a bit of inspiration to others, maybe other scientific disciplines as well. So what do you think can we all learn from the space industry these days, if something
evolved? Oh, no. What I love is that there is across multiple nations, groups developing technology that is more nimble. We're taking advantage of this ultimate change in microsensors, lower power microsensors, better batteries, to be able to do all kinds of more active satellite missions with much lower costs. And the launch options, because of all these awesome innovations, they're growing together. So the lessons here, there is growth in the ocean sensors. I use biogeochemically sensored floats, things like plant food, like nitrate and oxygen and pH of the ocean. We're implementing these sensors and we're deploying them on robot floats to be able to look at the full health of the ocean and its breathing and the ecosystems within it. This was never available before, because we basically could only look at the very skin of the ocean from satellites. Mm-hmm. And then deeper in, we had to wait for a ship to come by, which there are nowhere near enough ships to make the measurements required to look at the impact of big storms or changing jets or major. Did you know every major current on Earth, except the Labrador Current, has spun up, is accelerating right now?
Oh, wow.
Most people don't even realize that their ocean is activating. So I watch how robust that ecosystem is in space, and I'm jealous. I'm jealous because I work here in oceanography. Did you know there's only about 6,000 PhD research level oceanographers in the whole world, according to EGU and AGU, our geophysical unions? Yeah, 6,000. Wow. We're responsible for 93% of the energy imbalance, 1 out of 4 carbon molecules out of anybody's tailpipe, and 72% of the Earth's surface. And there's 6,000 of us out of 7+ billion people. Wow. We are the thinnest blue line you have ever heard of. And every university in the world has a geology department because of the oil and gas industry. Guess how many have ocean departments? Almost none of them. If you're not a Coast, a Scripps, or a Woods Hole, you don't have such a thing. Maybe you're part of an Earth and Planetary Sciences department. We don't exist. So this integrated, the space industry looks at the whole Earth and is involving the whole Earth's people with all this capacity building, new nations coming on as space-going nations. It's extraordinary how... Now, I don't think the regulations and the UN are quite keeping up with just how fast this is exploding, but I am amazingly just in awe of the combination of private, public, and university academic. This combination of growth in space is just a marvel to watch and to participate in. And this to me is one of the reasons I'm here at the University of Arizona, because we do space telescopes, OSIRIS-REx, the Phoenix Mars Lander. These are all University of Arizona projects. That's one of the reasons why an oceanographer is in the desert, is to take advantage of my amazing space colleagues' expertise and deep ties to their industry colleagues that are, helping leverage all this amazing new knowledge. Yeah, I'm jealous. I am envious and admiring deeply of this extraordinary human endeavor that has just exploded.
Beautiful. Beautiful. In your passionate call for support, you, I think at some point you mentioned, not in this show, but in a, on a different show, you mentioned citizen science also. So how do you feel about this? Would citizen science be necessary to team up to build this army of scientists and citizen scientists for a greener, sustainable future?
There's two parts of this. One, there aren't enough of us. We need help. It's not, it doesn't do you any good to have a bunch of PhDs saying this. We're talking across the back fence and making real change. Your stream where you run needs to make, we each in our own sphere need to do this work. And we need to do this in that same, not in that punitive, small, tight, regulatory only, but in the, in that awe-inspiring, wow, here's our space and this is what we could do with it kind of way. What are the innovations? And really what you need for that is more voices. Citizen science is the way. So there, some of the coolest things I've ever seen are, did you know they're catching fish pirates with citizen science? Regular folks get online. There's a couple of different platforms that do this and basically go through photographs of the lights that basically make incursions into marine protected areas in order to do fishing in protected waters. And then they hop back out. But what they've done is they've turned their transponders off so you can't identify the ships. Mm-hmm. You have to look at their hull and actually see which ship it is with their name and actually identify it. So here's how individual humans, like many, you don't need to be a scientist, but you can help make a marine protected area safe and successful. They are the nurseries for our ocean creatures. And without them, we continue to eat down the food web and the trophic levels. So this is a way that humans can be protective of their using, just by the way, great satellite data that wasn't already being used that way. It's so smart to actually look for the lights at night because, of course, they have to light up their decks and we can see it. So identifying those ships, and there's actually a means to report them to the individual governments through these. This is also web architecture. So I'm just, there are so, that is creative. That was done by not a scientist. That was done by somebody who heard a scientist talk and said, I know how to fix that. And I'll get my friends to help. Yes. Yes. Nice. We move together. All together now.
So everybody out there, if you have a solution, please tell us. Please tell the world. And if it doesn't work, let's give it another
shot. We'll try something else.
Try something else. You know what? I came across a beautiful idea expressed by computer game designer many years ago when it comes to making people aware of how they drive their cars, their fossil fuel driven cars. So he proposed to have next to the speedometer to have a little display with a green or with a tree. You have a digital tree right next to the speedometer. The more fuel efficient you drive, the greener that tree is. And the more you like race down the road, the less green it is. But the brilliant idea now is that this tree is connected to your social media profile.
Oh my goodness.
And so that was the idea. So next to your Facebook profile,
I would be in so much trouble. Oh my God, that's a great idea. My husband would love that.
Seriously, imagine next to your photo, you have that tree. And you could, if you befriend, or if we team up on Facebook, I would immediately see how environmentally conscious a driver you are. Like, that could be an interesting gamified approach.
I love all the gamification. It works for me. We found out that if you put inserts in people's bills, this has been done experimentally in cities in the U.S., where on their electric bill, and you just tell them how they're doing relative to their neighbors, not specific names or houses, but generally in your neighborhood, how your power consumption compares to others, that everybody in the neighborhood drops. Even the best, most efficient folk are will show off and drop it even more, which is extraordinary. We are very competitive. We're working on projects here in my lab and amongst my friends and colleagues on carbon accounting, where we want to make real-time carbon accounting available so that everybody knows that extra burp last summer was due to very inefficient use of coal. When we had a very hot summer and we hadn't built the capacity. We're also getting really excited about things like house batteries that just basically balance the load and make us more resilient in case of hazard where lines go down, et cetera, due to bigger storms. So imagine everybody has a house battery that they fill at night when industrial applications are less, right? Or when hot, et cetera. So you're basically balancing your load by charging your battery at night, running your house off it during the day so that we don't need to build new capacity. We simply make sure that those turbines are never running inefficiently and not being just burnt off because no one wants to use it at night. That is a distributed capacity that also means that if we had a bad storm and your neighborhood were blacked out, whatever, your house battery would go into emergency mode and would keep your refrigerator running through the couple of days it would take to get power restored. Right. This, especially for people who might have oxygen tanks or other health needs, et cetera, would save lives, basically, and keep us connected. Your phone doesn't go dead. So that they put up emergency portable towers for cell service, and all of a sudden we're safer and we're happier and our food doesn't go bad. There are so many of these individual things we can do. But I also just think there's a straight up, we all individually need to vote and tell our governments to move towards zero carbon power. They need to move towards zero carbon power. And these need to be, at least in the United States, we have to do this locally because of our grid problems. We have to do this regionally, like in our state, because a lot of the state regulations are actually where the power plants get built and by whom and what kind they are. And nationally, we need to put better, we have regulations that regulate carbon dioxide. We just aren't enforcing them. So at this point, we're prepared. We can do this. But in fact, that's where I think collective, individual, so there's citizen science, and then there's just citizens, right? There's straight up, what can you as a citizen do to move your country towards sustainable? And I want the United States to get their butts in gear. I am desperate for us to stop being lagging our European colleagues and start leading. We could. We have plenty of money. We're always building new cool things. Why not make more of that to save us a buck and do what many of the Germans and other Europeans are doing and sell that technology to save everyone's dollars and their lives, too? People have forgotten that air pollution is now the second leading cause of death worldwide. Air pollution is terrible. It comes primarily by burning things. And we can change our futures. We can. I have this tremendous hope, and it's going to take humans, not citizens, and citizen science and science, like all together. From beautiful roof to tree.
Right, to green tree. Joellen, I have one last question to you. And usually in that show, we have a tradition, and we've been keeping that tradition for now almost 2 years. And today I want to change it because the original tradition was to ask you for your espresso for the mind, because this is a space cafe, and an espresso for the mind would be some sort of energizing and inspiring whatever you want to share. But now I'd like to do something different today and push the envelope a little for you. And let's make this a bit more radical and perhaps realistic these days and necessary. So imagine you are the last researcher globally in line for a public appearance, and you have 2 minutes of airtime for a public appearance, and these right now are your 2 minutes. What will you use them for?
My kids and your kids and all of our children are depending on us to use our minds, use our science, use prediction science, use everything we have to try and provide for a better future. Now, this is not new. Every parent everywhere always has had to make this choice. But in this case, this carbon pollution that we've been spewing for decades and decades has gotten to the point where it's beginning to change everything. How much sunshine our children get to see, how often they get to play outdoors, how whether or not our homes are washed away. It's so important. It's so important. So what I want to say to everybody is this is going to take tremendous cooperation and hope and love. Love of this tiny pale blue dot, the spaceship Earth that we share. Love for our kids and our grandkids and the kids and grandkids of our friends and of our not friends and people around the world. We are going to have to lock arms together. Now, some of this is tremendous, awesome and amazing science that we're deploying to tell you who's been emitting and what and dumping it into our atmosphere. It's like the tragedy of the commons where everybody has been grazing way too many sheep and our commons is being damaged. And what your scientists have been doing and are doing now is basically tagging all of those sheep. We can tell whose sheep those are. Some of them are green and yellow and pink and purple, and we know whose they are. But now we have to actually pull back, find better ways to live together. This is such a challenge. And many times I think we're, in fact, it won't be, solutions may come from citizens. It may come from scientists. It may come from entrepreneurs. And all of these are going to be needed. So hug your loved ones. Try to turn the lights off. Write to your congresspeople and to your leaders and tell them how important this is. And let's do this together. We change our future. We chose. There have been moments in human history. World War II comes to mind. And I look at my own country and I think, it took us a long time to get in. We said, we can make a deal with that guy, Hitler. The physics are not so lenient. We will not be able to make a deal. We will have to make hard choices and changes. And I'm just hoping, with great love and affection for all of the people listening, for everybody who wants to see those grandbabies playing out in the sunshine and not the heat, that we'll do this together. That we are calling to all of you as scientists, Mayday, we need to turn the ship now. We need to move. We need to move quickly. It's not okay to wait. It's not okay to make it someone else's problem. We need to work together, and it's possible. Emissions in many of the developed countries are starting to drop. How much more could we do if we were determined to make this change? All together now.
Wonderful. Professor Joellen Russell, thank you so much for taking the time today. That's truly inspiring. Seriously.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me my 2 minutes. I'm just thrilled. We can do this. Hope. Hope and love.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
What a ride. I think I still need a little bit to digest Joellen's open honesty. Yes, we need an army, the biggest army this planet has ever seen. An army that will outshine everything, equipped with everything we can dream of, no matter what the cost. Let's saddle up, my friends. We know what's at stake. Our weapon is knowledge and wisdom. The former we have more than enough of. The latter, we need more than enough of. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with all those you care about. Maybe it will help ignite one or two sparks of inspiration. Maybe it's that simple. In any case, it's worth a try. Thanks for being with us today. I look forward to next time. Take care of yourselves.